Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Well, hello, and welcome to this episode number 72 of the Free Cities Podcast. I hope you're all well. I myself am back here in the UK, and the buds are very much starting to burst out. Slowly but surely, spring is on its way. I always forget how much I miss wet weather and rich green landscapes until I spend a couple of weeks in the Middle East. I really should remember that more, especially when I'm ranting about the bad weather over here. Anyway, back to today's show, and I have another conversation that was recorded last week in Dubai. I'm speaking with a gentleman by the name of Fred Roeder. Now, Fred is the managing director of the Consumer Choice Centre, which is a consumer advocacy group focusing on pro-growth policies, or, as Fred put it, promoting abundance for consumers. Well, he's also a Dubai resident, having chosen to relocate there recently. So there's a fair bit of chat about the UAE and the benefits of living there, as well as the evolution of cities in general, governance incentives, innovative US cities, according to Fred, healthcare, and we also dive into the pros and cons of democracy. Again, seems to be a pretty common topic of late. Anyway, don't forget to check out the show notes for any and all the links you could ever need to do with the Free Cities ecosystem, including our Telegram channel and, of course, our new Patreon, where you can support us with as little or as much money as you like. Failing that, I'm going to be brief. You know what I'm about to say. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Fred Roeder. Yourself and what you do here in lovely Dubai.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Fred Roeder. I'm the managing director of the Consumer Choice Center, which is a global consumer advocacy group focusing on pro-growth policies, achieving abundance, fostering innovation for consumers, and allowing consumers the lifestyle they prefer to choose.
And is that just a Dubai thing, or is that a worldwide thing?
That's a global thing.
Global thing. So presumably you have offices all over the world.
We have people all over the world, and exactly offices nowhere.
Oh, right.
That kind so of we're a team of 27 full-time employees right now, plus many fellows and part-time staffers. But we do not have a physical office because we live in the 21st century.
Nothing wrong with that at all. Yep. Are any of your colleagues chosen to live here in Dubai?
Not yet, but this could happen soon.
So why did you choose to live here in Dubai? Could you have lived anywhere? Was it a choice, or do you need to be here specifically for work?
I live in Dubai by choice. This was something I thought would never happen. I never saw myself living in a city like Dubai or in the Middle East in this part of the world. But I lived in London before I lived in Dubai, and had like my first COVID Christmas and lockdown Christmas. Thank you, Boris Johnson. I was not invited to his parties. So I had a rather dull Christmas and woke up on Boxing Day, and my partner said, "I look so sad, I need to get out." And I checked what few direct flights you still had from London Heathrow, and there was a direct flight to Dubai. At that point, already two or three of my friends escaped from London to Dubai. And the initial plan was just to spend like 10 days here for like a nice winter vacation. And then it's been now 3.5 years.
That's such a common tale that I've heard out here. Came for a couple of weeks, stayed for a few years. Seems like, and I was chatting to someone about this yesterday, but it does seem like there's been an uptick in the number of people coming to Dubai since the pandemic. Because last time I came here, nobody really commented on that fact. Last time I came here, it was during the pandemic, actually. This time, I've had a lot of people hit me up saying, hey, are you in town? I'm in town. And that's never happened to me before. So my anecdotal evidence is showing me that they're good. They're doing the right thing. They're being good at attracting, well, as we were talking earlier, new customers. Do you think that's about right?
Yes. So you have to understand that while the common perception tends to be that Dubai has massive oil and gas reserves, Dubai actually has very few oil and gas reserves. The neighboring Emirates and countries, some of them have a lot of oil and gas reserves and hence sovereign wealth. But I believe right now it's below 2% of the GDP of Dubai is oil and gas, and 98% is something different. And how Dubai actually makes its money is that it's a platform for trade, for people, for leisure, for fun, for healthcare, for education. And Dubai is a platform like Facebook or Google are platforms, and people conduct business on the platform Dubai. And Dubai has a competitive advantage compared to most cities and countries in the world when it comes to providing that sort of infrastructure. And I mean, let's just talk about a couple of things. Okay, so and this is anecdotal again, but arrived in Dubai as a tourist, had a return ticket, was supposed to fly back home to London, and then I realized, okay, I can actually get a residence permit while I'm in the country as a tourist. I don't have to go to the UAE embassy in London and submit my passport and show some proof of so on and so forth, but you can just do it here. The processing time for a residence permit and opening a business here was like less than a week. It's fairly easy and smart to settle down once you made your decision. And if you compare it to countries like the United States or most European countries where it's extremely hard to move to, if you don't have a sponsor like your company or your employer moving you to a different office, or you marry someone from that country, it gets really hard to move to a country. And Dubai is smart about immigration. Basically, everyone can come and figure out if they find a job or live here and make money elsewhere. Tax system is very good. There are very few taxes. There's a 5% VAT, and there's a new corporate tax, which is being rolled out right now, but there's no personal income tax and there's no capital gains tax. There are many airports. So Dubai has two airports, but then they're basically every emirate has at least an additional airport. So the connectivity is very good. So I think they are currently something between 10 and 15 daily flights to London alone. So you can really pick the flight by the hour. You know, I have to be in downtown by 2 p.m. So I take the 8 a.m. flight out of Dubai and I can still have a late lunch in London. And you can really pick it by how your schedule looks like, which respects your time. And I think the service economy here, which is both government and the private sector, have the consumer in the center. Your time is valuable. I'll give you an example. During COVID, we usually needed to have these quick tests or PCR tests to travel. No matter where you had to go, usually you had to show you're negative and vaccinated. That's, of course, has been a massive nuisance and expensive, but at least what you could do in Dubai is you have your app where you also order your taxi or Uber. And in that app, you could also just click on the service that someone comes to you, a nurse comes to your house, takes the PCR tests, and 2 hours later, you have the result. But you don't have to go to a testing center, which means you literally mute yourself in a conference call. Someone takes a swab, you pay something like 20 euros for it, and you get your results. And you don't lose half the day trying to get somewhere. I mean, I've also seen this and have done it now a couple of times for blood results. Yeah, someone comes to you, a nurse comes to you, takes your blood, and you get the same day, you get a PDF with your results. But you don't lose half a day again to go to a hospital, wait for 3 hours in line, take your blood, go back home, be stuck in traffic. So your time is valuable. And even when you go to government agencies for some paperwork or something you need to do with the government, usually the waiting times are very short. And for instance, at the motor vehicle registration office, you can even pay for a VIP pass. So you cut the line. It's a bit like clear in the US when you go through TSA. And you can do the same here even when you register your car, because you say my time is more valuable than, you know, spending 20 euros or dollars on a fast track is better for me than waiting for 2 hours in line. And these are government innovations and service innovations we do not see enough in other parts of the world. A good friend of mine coined it in a very interesting way, and I always have to say it was not me who created the saying, but a friend of mine said, Dubai is a city built for our generation. If you're the generation that uses apps, e-commerce, quick delivery, Dubai is the city for you, because the adaption of new technologies is very quick, and regulation tends to be very smart and adaptive as well. Probably also facilitated or enhanced by all these free zones we have within Dubai, that you can experiment, there are regulatory sandboxes where people can just try out things. And there are fewer people who we see a lot in Europe and North America who always say, well, we don't have long-term studies of this yet. We first need to run a 50-year long-term study on car sharing or ride sharing to see if it's safe or not, and then we can legalize it, right? And this is something we've way too often seen also when it comes to home food delivery in many European cities, where the unions come in and say, oh, these are not independent contractors, you need to get unionized, and we need to apply minimum wage, which then usually kills the innovation and means that we wipe out entire service delivery job opportunities, which means then these people are on welfare because they might not be qualified enough to do anything else. And in the city, you see a different approach towards this, being more innovative. You can see more things happening here with blockchain technologies, lots of trial, some error, but many successes. You have convenient ways of going to the airport. The roads are big. There is a lot of traffic right now, but still, compared to other cities, things are fairly quick to get to. And this is fun. And at the same time, especially for like British audience, where you have a healthcare monopoly by the government, Dubai has a very competitive free market healthcare system where you have different hospitals, different prices, doctors from all over the world. Doctors love working here because they don't have to do paperwork. They just treat the patients and someone else takes care of the paperwork. And that competition drives up quality of service, patient satisfaction. And you can also really pick what you like. You can go to the American Hospital, you can go to King's College Hospital, you can go to the Iranian Hospital. It's really what you prefer and what sort of treatment and level of luxury you want to have as a patient. And in education, it's the same. It's a competing, predominantly private education market. It's a market, and you as a student or parent of the students, you're the customer, and schools are competing to win you over. And that also means you can give schools or education facilities, institutions, direct feedback, and you can complain about things. I mean, try to complain to your municipal school somewhere in Europe if you're unhappy with the teaching style. They don't care. There's civil servants, their job is secure, and the school will get funded no matter if you're happy or not. And Dubai is different on that. You can pick the language of your school. It's amazing because you have that sort of choice.
I've never heard anyone call Dubai a platform before. I find that very interesting. Because I agree, it kind of is a platform. Yeah, I don't know whether you know, we've been making a film here in Dubai, and I've had to interview quite a number of people that have moved to here for the film. And one of the overriding kind of understandings that I've drawn from it is that a lot of the people that have moved here really do see Dubai, the place, or Dubai, say even the family, the royal family, as treating residents like customers rather than just tax providers. Is that your experience? Is that taking it too far? Or what do you think about that?
That is the business model. 90% of people in Dubai are foreigners. In many countries, when you have 10% foreigner rate, you already have everyone saying, we have too many foreigners, we need to kick them out, we need to build walls. And Dubai understands that you have to grow the pie to make it bigger. And that is by growing the city, growing the population, which of course then also grows the business, you know, consumption in the city, business, real estate development, and so on, the airline, and so on and so forth. And organically doing this population growth without mass migration is very hard. It takes decades, looking at human biology, how these things work. So Dubai grows a lot by immigration, and it works. It's a population where 9 out of 10 people are foreigners, and it works. We don't have violence on the streets. Fairly tolerant society. There are clear rules, but it works. And I think it also works because no one comes here and is entitled. You don't come here to get something for free. You come here because you like the platform, you like the institutions, you like safety, you like choice, you like low to no taxes. And then for everything else, you have to provide for yourself. And I think that really attracts a lot of people. And that then creates the business model for the local population, that you have a growing market where you sell services in, where you own land, where you own the airline, the ports. I mean, that of course then, you know, if you grow your customer base by 10x, that helps you. And usually people like having more customers. And that's the business model of Dubai, being that global platform, being very open. If you're a company relocating to Dubai, it's easy for you to attract global talent because it's easy to get work visas for your global talent, no matter if they're from Djibouti, Canada, or Taiwan. And that is really attractive and leads to this growth. At the same time, as a platform that provides services to customers and you want to keep the customers happy, you need to be careful about how many taxes you have. If you get too expensive, you might lose customers. If you're too restrictive on certain things, you might lose customers because people can really vote with their feet because they don't, 90% don't have the attachment to Dubai, that this is their home where they grew up and their families and grandparents are and so on and so forth. So it's in a good sense, a fragile system, which needs to keep the customers happy. And that's very different to the traditional governments probably we are all from, where it's really hard to actually lose your population. You need to be very bad, like East Germany style, where you need to build a wall that people don't leave, because and then you shoot at them. But Dubai has an incentive to be good to its residents. I don't want to say to citizens as well, but residents are the majority of the population. And that you do by having low taxes, good infrastructure. The weather is good anyways, but it's also by allowing new things. And there has been a lot of social liberalization in Dubai, especially since COVID, because they wanted to attract more people. And that's about rules on family and what is a family and so on and so forth have been liberalized. I woke up last year on January 1st with a massive hangover. And read the news that Dubai just axed the 30% alcohol tax overnight.
Sorry, which one? The 30%
alcohol tax.
Oh.
So that was cut overnight from 30% to zero. And I went to a liquor store that same day and saw 6 workers in that liquor store changing all prices on every single wine bottle. And that's, you know, a New Year's present you don't see in so many other countries, where the government just says, you know what? We want to be more attractive to people who like fine wine or good wine. And we might have to reduce our tax on this because otherwise people keep complaining and just buy duty free. And that happened. So this is of course great for expats over here that might also sometimes like to drink a Bordeaux.
Do you think that these kind of actions of governments and, well, the Emirati families out here will have any effect on the decision of governments where we come from to try and become more competitive? Or do you think that the life cycle of the West is in a certain stage that probably it may not evolve, it may de-evolve?
I'm trying to be the optimist always. if you look at cities, because Dubai is like a city state, so if you look at cities in North America and Europe, most cities, I would say, are currently in a bad shape in terms of governance. Local governments tend to be overly controlling, do the wrong things, tolerate crime, but increase taxes, and so on and so forth. Which is very unfortunate because there are some great cities. Just think about New York or London. There's fantastic cities which have many great things to offer, and that's why still many successful and affluent people live in these cities, despite maybe some institutions that are not great anymore. The incentives are probably set in a different way because as a policymaker, you care about your votes and not about making maybe the top contributors happy, the top taxpayers. Because one man, one woman, one vote. And that is, as a governance style, obviously maybe not the best. I mean, imagine you would have that in public listed companies, one man, one vote, and everyone buys one share and can always overturn the shareholders that have millions of shares, right? This would not really work. And you would have these activist shareholders and every Greenpeace member would buy one vote of ExxonMobil and then they would shut down the oil drilling. This is unfortunately this is just how the incentives for governance are set up in many cities, and that probably it is hard for these governance systems to pick up with more and more innovation happening. Things are getting faster. How should we regulate flying taxis? How should we regulate ride shares, Airbnbs, all of these things? And this is probably, there's too much inertia in many governance systems right now to catch up with this. Can there be disruption and will they compete? I hope so, because it would be great to have 500 cities governed like Dubai, or being like as clean and successful as Dubai all over the world. And if there's something better somewhere in the world, I think many people would move from here to somewhere else, right? This is competition, and it's fun to see that.
I mean,
one example is like there has been quite a significant influx to Dubai from people from Hong Kong. Many businesses have been moving their regional Asia headquarters from Hong Kong to Dubai because the political framework in Hong Kong gets a bit more tricky, right? There's more influence from the mainland China, the CCP, large consulting firms advise their consultants not to bring in any laptops into Hong Kong, only travel with burner phones. And these are like not just civil libertarians who say that, but it's like, I don't know, companies like Accenture say, or I think it was Accenture, one of these really large consulting firms who basically only take burner phones into Hong Kong because they're worried about cybersecurity threats posed by the CCP. And that is obviously a framework where it's really hard for a multinational to operate.
Yes. Can I ask you where were you from originally? Which place?
You can probably hear it. So
yeah, I know. But whereabouts in Germany?
Okay. I'm from the northwest of Germany, from a small university town called Göttingen.
Okay.
If you watched Oppenheimer, it's where he spent some years, and it's featured in the movie.
Okay. No, I was looking for a segue into talking about East and West Germany.
Okay.
But we can do it anyway.
I'm from the northwest, but it was actually only 20 kilometers from the East German border where I was born.
Okay.
On the western side, fortunately.
Earlier on, you used the example of Germany as creating a wall to keep people in. And obviously, it's alluding to the very obvious truth that somewhere like Dubai is the complete opposite. And if a Dubai-like city appeared in the south of Europe, I'm almost certain it would attract a lot of people from here, because going to live in the middle of the desert isn't something that you instantly think of as a good idea. However, the incentive model here is very strong in other ways. And as a result, you could argue, because Dubai is in the middle of the desert, it has to offer some very good incentives. Whereas if you were to try and incentivize people to go to somewhere in Italy near the beach, there would be less of a, you know, they would be trying a little less hard, I suppose, because they've got the environment that a lot of people like. So does at some point in the future, is there a life cycle of these kind of models where in the future of Dubai, Dubai is heavily ingrained. Maybe Dubai now has a long-term culture of immigrants here who are going to stay. So therefore they tax them more. So therefore they, because they know they can, because the barriers to leave are worse, you know, or stricter.
I hope your question can be answered in 50 years with, that was a silly question. Right now, the trajectory of Dubai is to become even more attractive for people to move here. And they're doing a lot, and there's a lot of space here, and there's a very positive attitude towards build, baby, build. You can see cranes here and like entire new cities or neighborhoods being created for hundreds of thousands of people. So right now we're on a growth trajectory, and you know, if you build a lot, you need to have people move in. There's still an incentive to attract people, and that is positive, also coupled with combined with a good planning laws and just a good master plan for the city. Yes, competition is always there. Yeah, and I mean, there are other cities and countries in this part of the world who are trying to compete and want to. And there's this NEOM project in Saudi Arabia, which some people are raving about, other people are skeptical about. I haven't been there. I haven't seen it yet. Let's see what happens. But one result, or probably one positive externality of Saudi also spending a lot of money on these infrastructure projects and some soft liberalizations, is that two Emirates in the UAE will have gambling very soon, most likely. So the Wynn casinos from Las Vegas is investing over $1 billion in a massive casino in Ras Al Khaimah in the north. It's about an hour drive from here. And Abu Dhabi most likely will also introduce something. They will have a federal regulator. They already hired the head of the regulator, which is an expat as well. They hired someone from the US, from Vegas, to head the regulator. And that is, for this part of the world, very, very progressive to introduce gambling, which obviously then will also bring in massive revenues, because you will have lots of charter direct flights from India, from China, from other parts of the Middle East. So that will bring in a lot of money. And that's more also a step towards alternative revenue generation, because you need to have some money as a city. Yeah? And if you don't want to increase taxes, you need to find other ways of bringing in the money. But obviously, I would be delighted to see, like, I don't know, some new smart city on the Amalfi Coast trying to compete with Dubai, because probably they would still be able to charge 20% taxes and might take 2 weeks and not a day to get internet in your apartment. Probably 2 weeks would be still very fast for Italy to get internet. And they would attract people, right? But I probably love Italy as much as you do. I love visiting, but whenever I hear from friends who live there how complicated things are. I have two team members at the Consumer Choice Center who live in Italy. And they always say, oh, this morning I cannot work because I need to go to this government office. I need to go to the post office. I need to do this and that. And I need to queue. And these are very long processes where you just kind of see, okay, that's actually something I'm not used to anymore, because things just work in Dubai. Another topic is connectivity. I had 20 megabit in London in my apartment. And I went from 20 megabit to 1 gigabit connectivity. So that's like 50x. And that makes a difference on your productivity as well. Because before that, it was usually during lockdown, like my partner and I had to always sync who's actually doing the video call and who's only doing a voice call, because we didn't usually have enough bandwidth to do two video calls at the same time working from our flat. So those are just competitive advantages I hope many other cities and countries will catch up with, so we can go to the next level. Right? We'll just have constant competition, more innovation. This is something we work at the Consumer Choice Center quite a bit on, also just explaining regulators why it's good to be bold when it comes to setting up like a regulatory framework that allows businesses and consumers to figure out things. Allowing choice, allowing competition and innovation, being just like pro-innovation, One thing we do now is we rank every year the best railway stations in Europe. And German railway stations used to be fairly on the top. And just in the last 5 years, we saw like a strong decline. Also thanks to like massive strikes and delays of the German railway company. The Telegraph actually just featured our index today. And funny thing is then the executive vice president of the German railway company who's in charge, that gentleman is in charge of the railway stations in East Germany, wrote us a fairly long letter of the letterhead of Deutsche Bahn, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, our ranking is not so great. And he doesn't understand why we use delays of trains as a ranking criteria. While the railway monopolist also owns the railway station, so I mean, it's the same government-owned company. So yes, you're responsible because you're all the same guys. And then we also did not take into account the environmental carbon-neutral aspects of these railway stations. Like, yeah, because consumers don't care. They don't want to stand at a dirty track for 2 hours waiting for their train, being harassed by muggers and only like mediocre food being offered. Right? So this is what consumers care about and not about some greenwashing in your annual report about the railway station that never sees a train because your trains break down all the time. Right? But this is a bit the alternate reality some of these special like government monopolists sit in and do not offer consumers what they want to have. So, yeah.
When you look around the world then, and I'm going to say, especially look in the what we would call the West, Europe, North America, do you see any cities innovating?
The United States tend to have always a couple of cities that innovate. And I once did a ruins of Detroit tour, which I love to see because Detroit, I think, used to be almost 2 million people. Now it's less than a million. And their entire neighborhoods that are basically depopulated. It's just empty. And it was interesting to see this former glory and the Art Deco, because it probably was one of the richest cities in the world at some point, like really pushing 20th century industrialization and automation. And then, you know, new cities emerge or become hip. Austin in Texas is one of these cities. Many people move to Austin. Right now, Miami is actually also getting very, very hot and popular. A lot of New York people, especially finance people, moved down to Miami because there's no state income tax in Florida. The mayor is very pro Bitcoin, pro investments. So you have this competition, and then either these cities that lose on population start innovating and become better, or they turn to the next Detroit, right? I mean, this can all happen within 25 to 50 years. And they are definitely some smarter cities. Predominantly in the South, or Charlotte in North Carolina is also one of these cities which is growing quite a bit. New, clean, maybe not culturally the most exciting city, but it's creating prosperity and people have good lives and jobs there. And then there are other cities, especially in heavily unionized states and with bad local government, which are suffering. I mean, San Francisco will be interesting to see in the next 10 years if it manages to kind of bounce back and become very attractive again, or if tech will slowly bleed out in San Francisco, because many tech companies or tech executives or startup companies are also not happy with the housing prices, which is mainly partially induced by geography of San Francisco, but also by like insane rent control policies that just did not help you. At the same time, it's not very safe on the streets of San Francisco. I think property crime below $500 has been decriminalized, so can basically steal everything or destroy everything that's $4.99 and nothing will happen to you.
I thought it was $900.
Maybe it's $900.
I think it is. Oh God, yeah, $899.99.
That's a big flat screen TV. Yes. And I mean, there was this one grocery store in San Francisco where I think the shop owner made everything $1 more expensive than the kind of minimum, and then he just gave discounts at checkout. But if you would steal it, you wouldn't get the discount.
Some funny. Interestingly, though, in your sort of dissection of the good places, the good cities in America, you picked the ones that the free places. Let's say the places that are relinquishing rules and regulations. As far as I know, Miami, certainly Texas, Austin, and Texas, those places. And the places that are losing people are the ones with more tougher regulations. I think it's fair to say in California. I mean, I'm seeing a trend here.
Yeah.
Obviously,
I mean, there are also parts of California that are very well managed. I mean, if you go to Orange County, it's actually still very functional. This is probably like one of the parts of California that are totally different than going to San Francisco. Where?
Why is that then? What are they doing differently than San Francisco?
Different local government, different priorities.
Different local, like a political party or the same political party doing it differently?
I think it's mixed, but you can also have like really bad Democrats or really bad Republicans or really good Democrats and really good Republicans. Well, Austin, for instance, is actually a liberal Democrat city. Texas itself is a Republican state, and lots of people who move to Austin say, well, it's actually great because you have like the Republicans in charge of your taxation and then the city government when it comes to kind of what you can do in the city. These are the Democrats. So it's the best of both worlds. I think it's just a mixture of just understanding what basically do you want to provide good services and a good framework and a platform again to people to attract them, or do you just want to kind of distribute substance to people as like welfare checks? Like substance in terms of things that have already been earned, like you're living off your substance, which is what some cities and countries unfortunately do.
It does seem pretty obvious though what attracts people. I mean, you don't have to be a political scientist to understand that what attracts people to cities, mainly, I would imagine, and Dubai's a phenomenal example of that because, as I said earlier, you've managed to attract large numbers of very high caliber people to the middle of the desert, which is a strange concept, I suppose. Doing it,
we do have great beaches here.
Right, okay. But they weren't, were they? I suppose, no, I was just thinking Burning Man. Burning Man is the time where they attract a lot of people to the desert. But so, and earlier on when you were talking about Dubai, you said you were, you know, saying hurry up Dubai to become more competitive because it will basically help the evolution of cities elsewhere. So what is the evolution of cities then? Like, what is it as Dubai sort of, you know, propels itself forward into the future and the rest of the world, or say the, you know, my country, the UK, tries to catch up. What are these innovations that places like Dubai are going to be adopting or elsewhere?
Even one step back, I would say maybe it's easier to build a new city than reform an existing city. Look at New York, fantastic city. I mean, it's, you know, the first real capitalist city. But, you know, try to renovate or update the entire metro system of New York. You basically have to tear everything down, right? But the property value of Manhattan might be, I don't know, trillions. I don't know. But it's just really hard to overhaul all of this, right? Whereas if you say you basically develop a small city, Dubai was 60,000 people in the 1960s. And now it's 3.5 million, so it's like a 20x growth. Imagine London would have grown 20x in the last 50 years. And that, so that, of course, gives you space to build something from scratch, which is probably easier than reforming something because it's a lot of infrastructure and how parks and houses have been built. And then you have not in my backyard, and no, we don't want to move out. And I'm obviously not a fan of eminent domain, right? And if you're not a fan of eminent domain, it gets really hard then to change things, right? Because you might just... Then you have the rare hamster, field hamster, in that one field, so you cannot build anything there because some fringe environmental group finds this reason, that reason, that just makes it harder. So we might maybe see some new cities emerging in the next 50 to 100 years we don't even know about yet. You know, it might just be a small town. And that, because that's basically what Dubai was, right? It wasn't really, not really much on the map. And now it's one of the big cities in population, still modest with 3.5 million, but in terms of attractiveness and branding, it's one of the cities now in the world, which is maybe not even so well known in North America. I was recently had lunch with someone very nice, and I told that person I'm living in Dubai now, and the person asked me if it's mainly like low-rise buildings or if we have also high-rise buildings in Dubai. So I was a bit amused by that question. I was not sure how to respond to
that. That was in America, I take it?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was a very educated
person, but you can see maybe the branding of Dubai still has to permeate a bit more to North America. And obviously for Americans, Dubai is also a bit less attractive because the US practices global taxation on its citizens, which is maybe something other countries or European countries might start doing to make it less attractive to leave, which is it's a tough one. I mean, Germany already has exit taxes, right? If you leave the country, you basically pay your last tax, and that's basically on the assets you take out. I'm not a tax expert, fortunately, I'm not.
I didn't know that.
But you have, and the UK has something similar, and it's getting also tougher because people see, okay, you know, if they leave the country and take all their assets, we make it really expensive for them, and then they don't do it.
It's so miserly, though, isn't it? Instead of competing, they decide to legislate, and that is such a miserly thing, and that's why everyone wants to leave.
yeah. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy then, right?
Right.
Yes. But that's unfortunately the response of some countries. I think mainland China also has some issues. They rather try and make it harder to leave, right?
What causes that to change then? Because I part of me thinks that's down to individuals as well. The actual individuals making the legislative decisions. They might be that kind of a person themselves. Then they're sitting there, sitting pretty. They've been, nothing's going to kick them out of their job. They don't need to innovate. They don't need to progress. They can just say, actually, no, look, instead of innovating, we will do everything in our power to stop that thing happening. And EU, obviously, Europe in general, has a massive reputation for that, doesn't it? Regulating everything rather than allowing innovation.
Yes. I mean, that goes to, like, I don't know, gene editing, GMOs, everything that's science. Oh my God, there might be chemicals in it. You know, I just had this one chemical here. I think it's like, I just actually put it in my mouth. H2O. That's like some interesting chemical. I mean, people are really very ignorant when it comes to science and innovation, especially people in the public sector. There's little understanding of technology. I mean, you can see this now with, like, I think Apple just got a 2 billion euro fine by the European Commission, and it's basically these kangaroo courts set up by the Digital Markets Act, DMA, by the European Union, where basically this kangaroo court can decide that you violated the Digital Markets Act. It's not even really clear what you did, but you were just, like, designated as a so-called gatekeeper. That means you're an important company. And then we say, we didn't like something you did, and here's your fine. And that fine can be up to 10% of your annual global sales. So a couple of tech companies are actually considering to pull out of Europe because they say it's so arbitrary in our risk management. We don't know if we get hit by these fines. And, like, 10% of annual sales is big. And this will, you know, maybe we just sell in other parts of the world and we pull out and we just have some franchise affiliate in Europe, right? But, like, a bit separated. It's like what happened to other industries, right? That they get split up. And unfortunately, the US is currently also heavily waging this war against tech. The Democrats hate tech. The Republicans hate tech. The Republicans say tech is woke and we don't like it. The Democrats say the tech got too big. We need to break it up. And if you look at what's the growth engine of the US right now, it's tech companies, right? I mean, if you look at the stock market, if you look at profit margins, if you look at innovation, it's like Apple, Google, Facebook, Meta. It's these companies, Nvidia, these companies that really create value, and basically everyone goes after them because there's so much you can take from them, instead of actually saying, well, apparently they're like, there's an industry that works, that creates jobs. What can we do to support them? And I'm not saying that they should throw money at these industries, but just make sure that the framework stays in a way that these companies can thrive and innovate.
Which would be to step back on the
whole. Yes.
I mean, what you're describing is certainly a part of it is a side effect of what I would call the burgeoning state. This large sort of state with too many people working there. Too many people trying to find a job for themselves and looking to generate revenue to pay for itself by basically, for want of a better expression, taking money from everyone else.
Yeah. And even, you know, taxation is one thing. The other thing is, like, stifling innovation by just over-regulating. And this is something you can see in medical innovation, in pharmaceutical innovation, where Europe actually has still very strong, great companies. I mean, the most valuable company in Europe now is Novo Nordisk from Denmark. And you wouldn't think that Denmark is like a shining star of free enterprise, but the most valuable company of Europe was able to, thanks to decent IP rules and like innovative, hardworking people, to become a massive company. And BioNTech in Germany, which was like working with Pfizer on the one of the COVID vaccines, becoming like a massive company. But then you have to ask yourself, what do you need to do not to lose these companies? And right now, Europe and the US still have a massive advantage when it comes to especially bioscience and pharmaceuticals. But I would tell policymakers to be rather careful not to lose these companies. And one of the things actually that's been now discussed in the European Union is to weaken IP law on pharmaceutical patents. And if you kind of think, okay, we got it actually now right the last couple of years, like a lot of the vaccines, whatever you think about them, but commercially very successful COVID vaccines were developed in Europe by European companies. Novo Nordisk with Ozempic, Wegovy, having like one of the most successful pharmaceutical products ever on the market right now, potentially solving obesity worldwide, which is a pretty good achievement. At the same time, basically, the EU is discussing to shorten patent protection. And like, okay, you lose these people.
I've never heard of that before. Are we talking about an injection that stops you getting fat or something like that?
Yes, yes.
That sounds like a recipe for a disaster.
Well, so you can get it over the counter in the UAE.
Already?
Yes. Oh, it's already on the market. That's why they're the most valuable public listed company in Europe right now.
So, is it like a pill that you take that stops your body digesting food or something? I don't know. That sounds like a terrible idea, considering how easy it might be if you think about how to lose weight. You could always do something else. But I've always thought that solving those problems with a pharmaceutical seems like a bad idea, because it's not attacking the root cause.
I might be more science enthusiastic than you, but it's a group of drugs that are basically called GLP-1 agonists. And it's something that basically reduces compulsive behavior in your brain.
Really?
Which means people eat less, they eat healthier, they drink less, they gamble less. And there are a couple of new side effects they figured out about, actually lower risk for stroke, lower cardiovascular disease risk. So it's a revolution in science actually right now happening. And we're finally, some of these drugs are on the market now for 3 to 5 years. Eli Lilly has the main competitor drug of this, Mounjaro, which is more or less the same, more or less. And these are very successful drugs. And I think it's clinically proven the weight loss is, I think, something like for males, it's like 12 to 15 kilos a year.
So I'm noticing where you might get pushback to this drug, the retail industry.
Oh, yes. So I already heard this. Like there were,
especially here. Can you imagine stopping impulsive behavior in a city like Dubai?
You can still have fun, but you have more years of fun.
But what about all those people that pop out to get a coffee and end up buying a handbag? You know, that's compulsive behavior.
Yes. The fast food industry currently is very worried. And I think you should rather short fast food stocks right now. But it's also really? The interesting thing of this.
Were you being serious there? Is it that much?
Well, I'm not giving any financial advice.
No, of course.
Disclaimer.
But do you think it's that big a deal?
Yes. So there is, I think Goldman Sachs one of these investment banks did a study on the impact on US airlines. And United Airlines alone will like save $80 million a year because passengers are less fat. Just like the fuel they will save. That's just one airline. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, $80 million is not all money in the world, but it's like an externality that is kind of, okay, we still sell tickets, but the average weight of passengers is, I don't know, 0.7 kilos less. So we actually save that in fuel.
But how do they know that weekend that you went to Paris on the as a last minute flight doesn't happen? So they lose in that sense because you're not being as compulsive.
Okay.
Well, no, I mean, that I'm looking at it purely from that perspective. You know, the number of times I've kind of changed my mind at the last minute, and spent some money is probably higher than the amount of money they'd save on fuel by me losing a couple of stone and, you know, in I don't know. No, but I am fascinated by this. I've number one, I've never heard of it before, which is always a good thing. But number two, that does seem like a recipe for disaster when you start. Do they know how many people are going to be taking this drug, for example? How do you predict how many people are going to be taking this drug?
You create some model. So the interesting thing is that probably a lot of long-term health costs will be actually been taken care of or disrupted, because basic diabetes type 2 will be a disease of history. You will still have type 1 because it's genetic, but type 2 will be actually, which is 95% of diabetics are type 2. Now that's like when you just ate and drank too much for like 20, 30 years of your life and you get it. That's, again, simplified. The interesting thing is the entire neo-prohibitionist to say we need to have sugar taxes, the Michael Bloombergs of the world, sugar taxes, fat taxes, we need to put warning labels on potato chips. They will have less arguments because people actually can control themselves much more, right? So that's kind of an interesting thing where you, again, see an innovation, and not regulation, but an innovation that actually solves things. And obesity is a problem. Diabetes is a problem. But all these rules and regulations and laws and taxes and bans of breakfast, having cartoon icons on breakfast cereals, which is actually a law in Chile. You cannot have Tony the Tiger on the breakfast cereals. They haven't helped us, but actually what helps us now is innovation. Well, and this is something I think that's better than regulation. If you want to help people, we need innovation and not regulation, especially not overarching regulation. I'm still a fan of certain rules and regulations, but they should allow enough space for businesses to innovate and consumers to choose. And they should also not prescribe what solution will be good for consumers. So this is something we call it the consumer choice and the technology neutrality. Regulation should not pick the winners and losers. Consumers should do that, because that's what consumers do in the marketplace.
Amen to that. Back to the drug, though. Do you know what the side effects are, other than reduced impulsivity, which it sounds like it's supposed not even a side effect, but...
Again, I'm not a medical doctor, and I need to be very careful not to imply that I'll
go and look it up on Google after this, but I just so didn't really
some people suffer from nausea from it,
which reduces weight even further.
Yeah, but it's not good. And so it depends on the individual with side effects, but they're fairly mild, and there are rather positive side effects, such as like a reduced stroke risk and much improved liver value. So it's pretty impressive. And
is this being issued in UK, North America already?
Yes.
But with prescriptions?
In most countries with prescriptions. And then you also have to see if you are diabetic, the NHS might even cover it.
Do they have prescriptions at all in Dubai?
Yes.
There are some things that have prescriptions. I was going to ask you that.
And I have a healthcare, not a medicine background, but a healthcare management background. And I would say even as a person for limited government, there are good reasons to have prescriptions for certain things. So for instance, if you look at antibiotics, if you just overprescribe them, it doesn't kill people directly, but if you use too many antibiotics, and there are these people who have like a flu virus and start taking antibiotics because they do not understand that antibiotics will not help you with these viruses, if you overuse them, you just you make them ineffective, and you get like antibiotic resistant germs, which then really create problems and kill people, and a lot of people. So having a health system, having some controlled way of not throwing antibiotics at everyone and everything, and you cannot just go to the pharmacy and grab like your stash of antibiotics, is a rather good idea, just to keep them effective, right? This is more like regulating the effectiveness of something.
So in Dubai then, with a free market of competition for healthcare, is it quite cheap compared to the rest of the world? What's your impression?
You know, the great thing about Dubai is whenever I ask you about price level of Dubai, or is it cheap, is it expensive? There's always only one answer, which is two words.
Go on.
It depends.
Okay.
you can I think you can buy an apartment in Dubai, a studio apartment, for $20,000 or for $20 million. That just depends how good, how much, how great, what's the view. And in healthcare, it's the same. I recently talked to someone who got their wisdom tooth removed, and I think the person paid something like £70 for it. And then I talked to someone else who got like a root canal, and it was £10,000. So
was the guy, did he have his tooth pulled out with a spanner or a screwdriver or something?
I mean, there was some local anesthesia. Yeah, but so it's just like, it's again, it's like, you know, you can go to, you can go to Primark and buy clothes in London, or you can go to Louis Vuitton, right?
Yeah.
And that's choice, and that's caters to different preferences and wallets. And healthcare in Dubai is basically like this as well. Same for education. So you can get it really cheap or very expensive. But actually, on the expensive side, I would still say that, so for instance, a regular birth, like a natural birth in a Dubai, in a very high-end Dubai hospital with like in a suite, 3 nights, good doctors, you might pay like £4,000. And if you do the same thing in London in a private maternity ward, you pay £15,000.
And how much do you pay in the US for that privilege? Quite an astonishing amount for
50, probably.
Yes.
Because maternity care is also covered by insurances. Because the interesting thing is, this is not my research, but other people have done that over and over again. If you actually look in the US at the only area of healthcare that gets cheaper, it's plastic surgeries, because people pay cash and there's competition. And the same for like eye surgeries like LASIK and SMILE. These things are actually getting cheaper year on year because people pay for themselves and there's competition. There's an incentive to be cheaper, better. Whereas if you have this behemoth of either government or private insurances that are supposed to cover everything, there's like this spiral of inflation. And doesn't mean that the service necessarily gets better, but there's just more like bureaucracy involved.
Do you happen to know if you get medical tourism in the UAE?
Yes, quite a lot. And it's interesting because just 15 years ago, the UAE was a big medical tourism player in terms of being an exporter of patients. So if you went in summer to Munich, there were entire hotels next to hospitals where like Emiratis spent 10 weeks, got all their things done. The government paid for these surgeries or treatments, plus the hotel. This has actually now changed, that the UAE is a net receiver of medical tourists. Within just 15 years, or let's say 2 decades, they're really able to invert this. There's still some specialist services some Emiratis travel to Europe for. But most things can be done in the UAE at a very high level and very quickly and good. So there's an entire free zone called Healthcare City. And you all free zone people are like free city people. And I might have gotten the term wrong, but it's like a healthcare city in Dubai, which is basically just for like healthcare institutions. And they have like a framework there really for healthcare. And that is very attractive also for medical tourists, especially if you look, okay, what's around here? If you live in India or in East Africa or in Jordan, there might be good reasons why you do not want to get treated in your country if it's an elective surgery. And then Dubai is a great place. You don't need a visa. It's English speaking, moderate prices, and you get quick treatment.
Turkey seems to be a favorite at the moment, if my Instagram stories feed is anything to go by. God knows why. I must be losing my hair, because Instagram knows it, and it keeps showing me like a fly on the wall, small documentaries about people going to Turkey, men going to Turkey and getting hair transplants.
Yes, yes. Turkey is also good at it. But I think in the premium area, Dubai can offer a bit more.
According to you then, as if you look at the whole of Dubai sort of in its wholeness, is it getting anything wrong?
There's a lot of trial and error, right? And this is just like probably very normal for platforms and cities and organizations.
I mean, I'd call that a positive though. Like, I don't mean is it failing? I mean, is it actually getting some things wrong? I mean, trying and failing is part of the process. But
you know, there's now this conversation. So they're doing this so-called cloud seeding here, where they kind of get planes up and kind of bring clouds from elsewhere over Dubai to rain.
Cloud seeding.
Yes.
Right.
And I think they have done a lot of this year, because the last 3 months we had like so much rain. And it's good we're getting like water into the city, right? This is actually good and it will get a bit greener and that stuff. But a lot of people are complaining about this. Like, no, we should just keep sunshine 365 a year. Like, we do not want to have these clouds and rain. This is like a joke among expats. Like, hey, I didn't order that weather when I moved here. but obviously, actually, there are good reasons. Like, the thing is, if you have rain, the air quality also improves, because just by its geographic location and the desert and the dust particles, we have actually not the best air quality in Dubai. And you can see after a rainy day, the sky actually has just been raining recently. So you can see actually now the sky is much bluer than usually, because there's less dust particles around. So it's probably a good thing we have the occasional rain.
So just clouds then, the only thing that's going wrong. What about policy-wise or legislation-wise? Obviously, they're bringing taxes are sneaking in. Do you think there's something in that? Do you think it's a prediction about what might happen in the future? I mean, it's obviously not enough to drive people away. And like you say, by its nature, you have a pretty mobile workforce here, I would imagine. So there's a limit to how much you can tax people, I would have thought.
Yes, it's going to be interesting to see how this is all going to be rolled out and play out with the tax. And
do you know why they're doing it, by the way? Do they need the money? Is that it? Or is it pressure?
I think there is a pressure to comply with like OECD rules, because something, and Dubai was just taken off the, or UAE was just taken off the gray banking list. Because what also happened is once people moved here and then they lost their bank accounts elsewhere because your residence is here. And it was harder to do business for some companies with UAE bank accounts and UAE businesses. So it's I think some sort of minimum compliance to not be the, you know, they don't want to turn into like being labeled as the North Korea or financial system or something like this, right? Because that's also a threat, right? If you get decoupled, you also have problems. Not saying that I want to justify any taxes, but you asked me about the motivations, and this might be more than revenue generation, just like some sort of compliance. Let's see how that all plays out.
As a Dubai resident, you almost certainly have an opinion on what's going on in Saudi Arabia. So what is your take? Everyone we speak to is, the buzz is Saudi. For, you know, everything that's going on there, you know, they're going to be competing against the UAE and the rest of the Middle East. They're building all these fantastical things. They are reforming. They are, you name it, they're doing it. So what's your take?
Yeah, let's wait and see. I've never been to Saudi Arabia, so the current airline they have doesn't appeal to me as a Western consumer. They're starting a new airline now once they have planes and these and cabin crew. We can, and the pilots hopefully as well. We can see if there's even a reason to maybe connect in Riyadh. But they're having very large plans, and it would be great if all these plans come to fruition. Yeah, they have this entire thing, the line, the city, which is just a long line, reads a bit like a short sci-fi novel, short novelist like this. But let's see if these things are being built. And I think just today they announced this 2-kilometer tower they want to build. 2 kilometers.
That's tall. 2 kilometers tall.
Yes, yes.
How tall is the Burj Khalifa then?
812 meters.
Oh, really?
Yes, still standing as the tallest building in the world. So let's see if there will be a 2-kilometer tower, and then maybe Dubai can answer with a 2.1-kilometer tower.
Haven't they got a half-built tower in
Saudi? Yes, that's the Kingdom Tower in Jeddah.
That was supposed to be bigger than the Burj Khalifa, wasn't it?
Yes, and designed by the same architect, actually, Adrian Smith from Chicago, but that did not get completed.
So they've announced a 2-kilometer-tall tower. Have they announced a date of starting to build the massive foundations or whatever the hell they need to do for a 2-kilometer tower?
I only saw the headline today and some friends of mine commenting on this, and let's see if, like, I mean, obviously if you want to do this, you can do it, right? So maybe they will do it, and that will be very interesting, because that creates more dynamic. Let's see then what what Dubai does, what Doha does, what Abu Dhabi does. You know, that's competition. And I hope all these projects will come to fruition and succeed, because that means we live in a world with new cool things, right? So this kind of local patriotism and no, we still need, like, we will always be the best, or I'm worried that the other's getting better. No, this is good because it pushes you to strive. And I think that's a good thing. You know, building faster and higher things is a good thing. And if we would always do this properly, we'd already have like Moon and Mars colonies, maybe. Yeah, but it's something where we should never get complacent, and we should always strive for more, because there's more prosperity to create.
When we were in the offices of Zaha Hadid, the architects, last week, and plastered on almost every wall, every shelf is something that's sort of being built either in the Middle East or certainly out in Saudi Arabia. And I have to say, and obviously a 2 kilometer tower is also included in this, they are pretty impressive designs, and they do look like the future. It does look like the kind of thing that you maybe one day will look back, and when the things like that are quite normal, floating cities, flying this, you know, all that kind of stuff you normally just see on science fiction films. If anywhere, it's probably going to be built here. I mean, simply because all the architects we speak to say, yes, you can build things like that here. And actually, it's quite simple, because you really only have to deal with one family and get the go ahead. A lot of the leaders around these parts get to think quite long term, get to think because they know that they'll be passing on their leadership down a family line. What's your view on that? I mean, as someone that's into the sort of evolution of cities, you must see the democratic process as both good and bad.
Yeah, it seems to start with like this. A lot of people tell me, oh, but Dubai doesn't have any history, you know, like, don't you miss like the old buildings? I'm like, sure, I love being like in a small town in Italy, I don't know, in Tuscany, with like narrow streets and beautiful old buildings. That's fantastic. But we just have the future, right? Yeah, things are being built and everything you look at is new. And I don't mind new, you know, that's actually good. Yeah, because it also works. And there's definitely a yes in my backyard attitude here. And you can never be sure that the view out of your living room or bedroom will stay the same, because in 2 years there might be another massive tower in front of you. But that's rather a good thing, because you things are happening. And I mean, London is one of the few cities in Europe where you actually have some architecture and new buildings, right? The city saw a lot of new buildings the last 10, 15 years, which is great, because that means London has a beautiful skyline. But so many cities even have a debate when they want to build like one skyscraper. It's like, oh no, do we really need to have a skyscraper in our city? It's like, yes, you do. Many of them.
I think it's about managing expectation. I think, like you said, when you move into a high rise here in Dubai, you are already expecting that at some point your view may change. And that doesn't happen in ancient cities in Europe. People are very careful and very protective over their views, because they have been there for hundreds of years.
Yeah, and that limits growth, that drives up housing prices, brings people to commute for 2 hours each direction, 4 hours a day or whatever. Whereas if you just build and make things denser, more dense, that's actually a good thing. And if you don't like density, then just move far, far outside. And the anti-density people should have the long commute, and not those that ban and inhibit making things higher and more dense in cities.
Last question. I can see we're running a little bit over time. It's a thought experiment. Where and what would be your preferred place to live? And it doesn't have to exist. It could be a Dubai-like city on the Amalfi Coast. It could be anything. Describe it.
It would have vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
maybe it can fly.
Right, we're going very futuristic.
Ideally, within 1 hour of driving from winter ski slopes, but also vineyards.
Do you need a dynamic city that's evolving?
That keeps things exciting, yes. And your mindset is totally different. If you live in a city that changes every day, you also change and you strive. And looking at high-rise buildings tells you every morning, this is something to do. And there, someone builds a new high-rise buildings, motivates you to also challenge yourself. What else can you do differently and improve and grow? And I really see that different mindset for people who live here.
And where would it be? I mean, are you particularly wedded to the desert? I suppose I would say.
I'm a person with allergies. So the great thing is actually if you live in the desert, your allergies are gone. So that's a nice thing.
Although what I've noticed is my eyes itch like hell when I come here. Mm-hmm. And I suspect it might be just the very small particles of sand in the air. But last couple of nights, it's been excruciating. Just like, and I noticed on a friend of ours, another guy that I interviewed who lives here, he's got really, the insides of his eyes are pretty red as well. I'm wondering whether there's some kind of pollution or the sand maybe.
It's just the spice. It slowly turns your eyes blue.
Right. Okay. Quickly then, where is this place if you could choose? I mean, I'm thinking there might be a business model to be had there because... I mean,
if you have something like Malta in terms of climate, that's pretty good. I think if Malta is also a small place. If they would be a bit pragmatic, then maybe that's a place to consider.
Do you know about Prospera in Honduras, the Free City Project?
Yes, and I'm skeptical for me personally, like not being a customer, because I want to have a big airport, I want to have good hospitals and good schools. For that, I don't want to move there.
Sure. You may, you wouldn't be a first mover for sure. Yeah. I think theoretically in the future there might be, it's on an island, so, but it does have direct flights to Miami and things like that, you know. No, I just wondered whether that kind of tropical environment might be the place because...
Too many animals.
I mean, it's very, okay. It's very interesting to think that Dubai's Achilles heel might be its climate in the sense that there's a reason why the kind of residential areas are getting greener in Dubai because people want that. And it takes a lot of energy probably to keep those places green, I would imagine. So if somewhere like Dubai was to just pop up in a place that was more conducive to the kind of... you know, Northern Hemisphere type environment. Right.
I mean, yeah, sure. But I mean, the energy problem also is not a real problem here because what they just did is like to build this massive nuclear power plant in Abu Dhabi that's like now fully online with 4 reactors and I think 5 gigawatt. I think that's it. Something like this, 5.2. And that already provides 20% of the country's electricity. Right, and if you grow, you just build more nuclear power plants, and they built that entire power plant within 7 years or 8 years.
That's what I was going
to say. The US, it takes 25 years to build one. Yeah, so it's just other lead times you have here also to solve problems.
Yeah, and so I mean, it's the biggest reason why people say nuclear is not the future because it takes so long to build them, which is a misnomer.
Yes, it was on budget and it was on time. The Koreans build it. So, but it was just like if you have a company that can build it for you and you know they can build safely, you might not want to put massive roadblocks in front of them. I recently talked to like a senior executive of an energy company in the US and that person was just like, yeah, it takes us too long to build nuclear power plants. That's why we have problems.
Mm. Okay. So
that's energy abundance. We can achieve it.
Well, I mean, presumably as well, I don't know if I'm guessing here that the solar possibilities here are infinite, I would say. But is it a technology that's worth producing if you can create a a nuclear power plant, really.
Yeah, they mix in some solar. Probably if there's a good place for solar, it's in this part of the world. But the question is still, is that like actually, can you create cheap energy with it? Because you need a lot of electricity here for water. Most of the water we use here is desalinated. And that's something you need a lot of energy for, and cheap energy, because otherwise water gets expensive. So I had a friend from California visiting me here, and he asked, like, where's all the water coming from? I'm like, yeah, see, there's like an ocean, like there's a sea. He's like, yeah, but we don't have water in California. I was like, yeah, because your electricity is too expensive. You have cheap energy, you can have a lot of water extracting it from the ocean.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
problems are there to be solved.
They are. And it's certainly the place where problems are getting solved. Well, thanks for giving us a little insight into what it's like to be here and your city of the future, which did I find out where it was going to be? No, you didn't. You said it was...
I mean, we might meet at the Amalfi Coast.
Okay. Okay. Amalfi Coast it is. Sounds like a plan. Well, anyway, Fred, thanks for coming
Thank
in.
You so
thanks
much.
For talking to us. And thanks for the stimulating conversation.
That was fun. Thank you very much.